Hey there, welcome to episode 18 of the Open Floor Podcast. I'm Ali Mosalleh.
And I'm Aryan Narayan. Welcome to the first ever in-person episode of Open Floor. Today, we'll be recording straight from Lexington High School, and we're so excited to be in the room with our guest for the first time, who we'll introduce shortly.
I have to say that I've been waiting for our in-person episode, so let's just get right into it. So traditionally, our episodes have been focused on a specific topic, but today we wanted to try something a little bit different by having a more open-ended conversation about a more diverse variety of topics.
So today we'll be talking about the importance of education and teachers in our communities, and to discuss this with us, we'd like to welcome Mr. Patrick Flynn, who is a world history teacher at Lexington High School, and a lot more than that, as we'll soon see. So thank you for joining us today.
Real happy to be here.
To start off our discussion, could you tell us a bit about yourself and your background?
Sure thing. I am obviously a teacher. I am your former teacher. perhaps relevant of interest. I also play music on the side. Most emphatically on the side. I am not traveling on tour 8 months out of the year. A colleague once told me that she was at a grocery mart in Burlington, and the register clerk was like a high school kid, and you know, she's like, "Oh, you're in high school?" And he said, "Oh yeah." And then she said, "I'm a teacher too." And he's like, "Oh, where do you teach?" "Lexington High School." And the kid apparently was like, "Do you know who Pat Flynn is?" And she said, "Yes, he's one of my colleagues. I teach right next door to him." And then the kid said to her, "Is it true that he's on tour 8 months out of the school year?" And she said, "Nope, he's there every day." And so I have a music background, a weird one, because I started in high school as a hobby, and it always maintained a hobby. But I, you know, had success. I went to every continent except for Antarctica. It's not much of a punk music scene in Antarctica currently. That can change. But I always was passionate about history and history education. And that's really where my heart lies. And in fact, at the top of the game of the band I started in high school, I decided to quit because I was so inspired to become a part of the project of teaching history. Mm-hmm. So to the listeners of the Lexington High School community, I'm not on tour all the time. And I play music on weekends with my friends in terms of writing, which is my favorite part. And then occasionally, I'll find a late flight on a Friday to California or Chicago, and I'll get there at 9 p.m. and rock a gig and play somewhere else nearby on Saturday and come home Sunday morning to being a father and a husband to my family, which are obviously the most important things part of my life. But that is, in a nutshell, who I am.
Yeah. So first of all, very impressive to see that you're both a musician, a father, and
not
also
really a musician, though. I kind of don't really feel like a musician because it never – I don't – like, artist sounds so, like heavy, but I do like to create art, but I just don't, I always felt weird about saying I'm a musician, but I there's something about it. Maybe just cause I'm not full on committed.
Sure.
But anyway, I'll take the title. I'll take the artiste title.
Sure.
As well.
Sure.
My heart and love is in history.
Yeah. And so being a world history teacher. And so what motivated you specifically, to become a teacher and then specifically become a teacher of world history?
Yeah. So there's two like turning points in my life, or I would just like moments that I turn back to when I try and figure out like why I ended up where I'm at, obviously in hindsight. But the first one was when I was in the second grade. I was an army brat, so I moved around a bunch, and where I moved to, like, my whole family tree is from Boston. But my father joined the military out of Boston Latin School. He went to West Point and became an officer right out of undergrad, and just traveled around and then had me along the way. And in his last year in the Army as a lieutenant colonel, he was Colin Powell's speechwriter, actually.
Wow.
Always a little, he wrote the good speeches, though, the one in the 90s, not the one that, sent us to war erroneously. Father did not write that speech. He did not give that intel. Nonetheless, In his final year at the Pentagon in 1990-91, I forget what it was. I was in the first grade not learning how to read. And it was a quick year. My mother was like, you know, removing her entire clinic and to Massachusetts. My father was getting ready to start a brand new career as an educator in his like retirement. It was a little chaotic. I'm the youngest, and usually the youngest just gets kind of not forgotten, but less worried about. But I wasn't learning how to read in the first grade. The first grade teacher wasn't doing the job right. And I'll never forget the first day of the second grade in Massachusetts at this small little Catholic school when the new teacher, Mrs. Brunel, wonderful, she just, you know, presumed that I knew how to read. And she said, why don't we let the new kid, Patrick, start off reading for the year? And it was like a picture of these two frogs. I didn't know even know the right page number. And I had my classmate got me to the right page. And there was just like pictures of these two frogs fishing. Because I'm clever and witty, I decided to make up my own story. And then the teacher was like, are you on the right page? And I was like, sure am. Are you on the right page? But for real, though, I was I'll never forget the fear and the anxiety coursing through my veins. And it wasn't because I just don't know how to read. It was because I was like, wait a minute. All of these people can do something that I can't, and it's a whole world of imagination that I'm missing out on. I felt like I was, in some respects, without vision. And I just felt like on the outskirts of opportunity. And so rather than holding me back, I missed recess for the entire year learning how to read with this very devoted, nice, and kind nun at the Catholic school I was at named Sister Louise, who just patiently taught me how to read, caught me back up to speed, and I won the spelling bee that year. I won it again next year, and then in fourth grade I won it. Yeah. And if they had it in fifth grade, I probably won that too. nonetheless, though, I knew what it was like to be on the outskirts of that. Sure. And then I fell in love with history with my history teacher, Mr. Hall, who I had for 3 years, and he really had an interesting approach that I wouldn't really find again until I was in my senior year of college, studying history at a more kind of academic level where you're doing it, and I wouldn't really experience again until later in grad school. And because like that was middle school, though. So then I got to high school, and I just it was very lecture based, which is a part of the puzzle, part of the process of being able to do history. You have to gain some information, but it was just pure lecture, and it was passive, and it just kind of felt like a glorified story time, like in kindergarten. Which is a useful thing at the kindergarten level, but you know, your brains are developed to a point where application, like true application of really kind of complex ideas, sure, is ready to go. And I wasn't having that experience, and I just kind of fell out of love with that, and then did what any teenager would do, is I turned to punk music. and that story is more or less already been told. When I got to college, I was so dismayed because Mr. Hall, middle school, gave me another set of keys Sister Louise gave me the keys to read. And then Mr. Hall gave me the set of keys to love reading, but specifically love reading history, and then also love doing history. And I didn't have that in high school. And it was really tough. And I was lucky to just somehow bounce around into this punk music community. And like, man, oh man, it just really saved my life, because I was like, I hate school. I was like, this is a waste of my time. I wanted to create, and I found that in music and community events, like booking shows, which clearly aided me in my life. But I was, you know, touring the world, and I was also noticing that the ways in which I had been kind of implicitly learning about the world, whether it was from friends, relatives, teachers, media, was not measuring up to the people that I was encountering, whether it was in Thailand or in Durban, South Africa, or in Santiago, or in Sweden, or Monterrey, Mexico, or in Australia, like wherever it was, all those stereotypes were not measuring up. And I just felt, you know, I truly inspired to like just be a part of not just like history writing, but the process of doing history.
Sure.
And that kind of, and at that point, I had to make a decision what I wanted to do for graduate school, and I really had to weigh my options of law school, ed school, and I chose ed school. And I got to say, I'm so happy with my decision. I go to work. I love my job. I'm not the wealthiest man on the block, but like I financially speaking, but I feel pretty wealthy. I got a great gig, and you know, sure. I get a lot of family time. And it's good, fulfilling work in life, and I'm real happy for it.
That's great.
So again, you've talked a lot about.
we're sharing microphones, listeners. No worries.
So again, as you talked about the importance of so many people and teachers in your lives, like Mr. Hall, what, in your opinion, is the importance of teachers in our community in like forming the lives of like these growing people?
That's a great, the role of the educator is something I take quite seriously. I'm pretty passionate about like John Dewey and Paulo Freire are like two of my like heroes in education. And B.R. Embedker are like heroes of mine when it comes to like just thinking about education, and they all have the common spirit, this thread of like education as a vehicle for advancing democracy and the benefits that come within a democracy, that being equal opportunity and, you know, to a certain extent, you know, justice. So I've just, you know, in my own personal experience, it was, you know, my father grew up pretty poor. And it was, you know, it was through his educational experience that he was able to kind of overcome that. And you have a really wonderful, full life that was not totally destroyed by the trappings of poverty. So just on that level, but then to my own level, which like I just explained, you know, having teachers, kind of work as that kind of safety net for, you know, whether it be, you know, a lack of help at home or just something else, is so vital to creating the type of person or citizen that you need for a thriving democracy. Mm-hmm. So I do see the teacher as, you know, really responsible for, not totally responsible, you know, home matters too, and the legal system, of course,
sure.
Despite what people tend to think that everything, every fault in society is the fault of the teachers. But, a huge point of that is democratic education, and I'm not talking about taking like, you know, a civics course or government, but a type of educational experience that promotes discussion, critical thinking, questioning, a sense of togetherness, community, and also a sense of really profound individuality and how to respect everyone's individuality and their social belongings. Mm-hmm. So, you know, much of my philosophy comes from those big kind of, big thinkers. When I would, I'd walk into certain classrooms in grad school at Columbia where John Dewey taught the likes of, B.R. Embedker. And I remember just trying to be like, oh man, I wonder what this was like. But oddly enough, what I'm told is that John Dewey, for all of his like promotion of like a democratic education or promoting democracy through schooling, apparently his classes would just be an experience of him sitting in a chair, looking out a window, and just kind of like talking out loud, not even really at the students. And then at the end of like an hour and a half, he'd be like, well, I think we figured that one out. And then class would be over. So very authoritarian in experience, but sure. Figures like Paulo Freire promoted this idea of like the horizontal, the vertical classroom where to avoid the banking method, which is where you just kind of open someone's head and you pour information sure. in it, and you don't try to inspire the critical agencies of the people. It's a tricky game to do it. Freire was really talking about adult education in a borderline fascist dictatorship era of Brazil. But it's hard to do that with young people. It really is. I was all like wide-eyed when I first encountered Pedagogy of the Oppressed by Paulo Freire. I was like, that's the kind of high school teacher I want to be. And I was like, when I started teaching, I was like, it's harder with high school kids. And then I was like, oh, wait, he was talking about adult education. Well, that's why it's hard. That's why it's much harder. But, you know, you could probably think to, you know, our time together in class, you know, it was a lot of time where, like, the students were – it would look like the students were running the show, you know, with how the activities were set up. And that was to promote the experience of discussion and conversation that is the lifeblood of a democracy. If you don't know how to have disagreements in a healthy way, or you don't even know how to debate or discuss, you're going to wind up with things like storming the Capitol in cold winter months like January. So maybe there's a higher call for greater democratic education in the Deweyan philosophy. That's just my two cents.
As you mentioned before, Aryan and I were both in your class sophomore year, so that would be 2019 to 2020 school year, and so we were in your AP World History class. And so for listeners who might not know about the AP program, it's a globally standardized program where teachers have to follow a preset curricular framework provided by the College Board, which supervises the overarching AP program. And so what are your thoughts on the College Board and advanced placement? And how have you managed to maintain such a dynamic style of teaching that you have in some examples where, like, the end of quarter debates that we might have, or even like the general debates that we had, or just the individual, like, critical learning experiences that Aryan and I had while being in your class? So how do you maintain this kind of balance between a more structured form of curriculum and your more dynamic form of teaching that you've learned over the years?
Yeah, sure. Was one of the questions there, what's my take on the AP College Board?
Yeah, okay. Sure.
Yeah, you know, I'm not like this like firebrand socialist, like Bolshevik who wants to like destroy the system, you know, who hates capitalism with every fiber. That's not who I am. Sure. I'm an historical thinker who sees the complexities in everything. But I do think it's worth noting that, you know, the AP, the College Board is, you know, is a non-profit that makes a lot of profit.
That sure.
Makes a lot of money. And I just, I'm always skeptical of, you know, when money and education are, you know, thrown into the same bag.
Sure.
You know, it's not useful for them if everybody's doing well on the test. Because then it looks like it's not really creating winners, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm very much so fascinated by the concept of mastery learning, which is saying, like, hey, listen, you can redo this a million times. You just have to demonstrate that you can do it. The thing about mastery-based learning is that it's a logistical nightmare because, you know, time exists and there's not much of it, really.
Yep.
And so in retakes, the educators, the people doing the assessments have to really, like, if you've taken a test for the second or third time, that's the teacher evaluating for the second or third time. With, you know, just for perspective, when I give 3 minutes alone to students, like, in their work, their writing, it's like 675 minutes, no, 375 minutes, which comes out to basically a work day. And that's just 3 minutes. So, like, the load is huge. So, you know, like, when you've taken a mastery approach, it's logistically really, really, really tough.
For sure.
But I'm quite passionate about it. It's really great research in its effectiveness. It's kind of a logistical nightmare, but I'm very passionate about it because the research shows that it's actually really effective at not just helping students, like, you know, score well, but motivation. Because you're not so, like, well, destroyed. It also pushes students to be really okay with failure. I've started putting in letter grades. You know, I do mastery checks. Yeah, they're tiny. They're just quick questions. Sometimes they're about skills, and you either get an A or you get an F. And I want students to be completely okay with seeing that letter. I don't think it's ever going to change. I don't think we should. We don't want to have a Band-Aid solution. Failure is our friend. It is informative for us. But in a culture like we have, it's hard to see failure as a friend. I do think that, you know, money-driven, corporations and entities like the College Board. And I don't think it's a pure nightmare that should be lit on fire or anything like that. I look to the College Board as someone who's a true believer, not a true believer, kind of makes me sound like an ideologue, but someone who believes in the power of mastery learning.
Sure.
And the nature of how you make money and how you keep people paying money, mastery learning is not really going to factor well into that. So I'm also a huge believer in the power and the research that shows that especially in history education, when you lead with skill-based instruction, that problem, especially in history, of like trying to retain information actually isn't a problem anymore. So even if you are the content-driven educator, or even the content-driven student, you're that much more likely to be like involved and passionate about the doing of the learning than just sort of the memorizing of learning. You asked, how do I kind of balance the two? Well, you know, I understand that there's strengths and weaknesses to everything in life. So I don't bemoan the existence of the College Board. I've worked with it. I really like the structure. I think it's a great thing to have for students who are coming from places where maybe home life is not the most convenient or awesome place for support, because they have the AP Classroom now. There's all these extra resources, so there's just these awesome advantages that the College Board has, and you can get a read at a global level of what people are thinking, which is great for data. However, I do think that it gets into the kind of status-based way of kind of thinking about education, which always bothers me. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I just kind of go with what I have seen to work in the research and what's worked for me. And I've never really encountered this massive drop-off in AP scores, despite the fact that I'm not lecturing constantly in class. And I have found our scores to be quite strong. And I credit that to the town and the support. Also, I do think that there's something to be said about having an opportunity to really question and criticize who Samuel Gompers was. No one remembers him. No one cares. But like, you know, if you were giving him if I was teaching AP history, I would totally choose Samuel Gompers as one of the topics for our historical significance debates, because he's obscure. No one knows about him. He's actually quite a historically significant figure. But in that process of really debating Samuel Gompers, you're going to come across all these other things that were information history that you're using, and you're trying to argue and debate. I think that's an effective way to teach history, and I've seen it with my students, and it's tough, but it's a little more enjoyable than the lecturing.
A major theme that is emphasized in your classes, as both Ali and I experienced, is the importance of like human acceptance and fighting social injustices. So what do you think the role of education is in fostering that accepting society that we all should work towards, and fighting the social injustices that we've discussed? And how have you worked towards this in your own classroom?
Yeah, that's super great to hear from students that's the case.
Yeah.
Because my main approach to teaching is to teach critical thinking. And to let the morals to be pulled from history, moral lessons to be pulled from history by way of like student observation. And as I said before, I definitely see the institution of public education as like a vehicle for creating a democratic society that is going to be better and better every era at making sure that everybody has a fair shot at the good life. So I'm just sort of thinking that my role, like, I wasn't like, my students will understand humanity and, like, human acceptance. And I just wanted to take the historical stuff that we've studied and that's in our curriculum and really just, you know, like, see what you pull from it by way of learning how to think critically, whether it's through learning how to really interrogate a document, you know, and sourcing and contextualizing, you know, looking into the subtext by close reading, cross-checking, but also thinking about significance and causation and continuity and change over time. So there's really interesting, like, just basically objective questions to be asking that can make it easy to develop some type of, like moral way of looking at the world. But I want to make it clear, like, I really don't come in as, like, a moralizing teacher. I say that very much so explicitly because I grew up being raised Catholic, going to Catholic school where you had a full, like, we had one class called moral, like morality. And it wasn't a philosophy class. It was like, this is why you're going to hell and this is why you're not. And nothing pushed me further away from thinking about the concept of morality or what was wrong or right than having a moral-based education.
Sure.
And that's not to say I'm against, like, teaching moral, like, you know, against the idea that morals can come from one's learning. I just think that it's not the way you do it. Like, the individual has to really have some type of agency over their idea of what is right and wrong. And I don't think that a third party gets anyone there. So I'm a huge believer in the role that, like teachers have a responsibility to really provide rich critical thinking, like opportunities to really understand, you know, like, how to come to meaning and to constantly be not creating the cynic, but the skeptic who says, why should I believe that? But, you know, the skeptic says, why should I believe that? And then doesn't say, I don't want to believe it. That's the cynic. Skeptic says, why should I believe that? Is the evidence hold up? Interesting. Well, if, you know, and you kind of just sort of break it down on a basic logic. It's like, if you are someone who is interested in the welfare of humanity, then it's rather easy to be a critical thinker and arrive, no matter what you're studying, if that is your North Star, to be thinking like, oh, by way of being taught how to, like, think rigorously and critically, I tend to see the humanity and the value of looking out for our common threads as a species. But also in acknowledging, like, simultaneously our common threads as a species, but noting the rich variety of our differences as well, which is hard. But yeah, I just, I personally don't think that the role of the teacher is to craft the mind. I think it's a fool's errand, which is, like, you know, really, truly, there's all the wonderful intentions. We want to, you know, like, absolutely, totally, and entirely eradicate every ism that we hate. And I just think that most teenagers look at what their teachers are offering. And if it's coming in the form of, this is my morality and this is my ideology and you need to take it, they're going to take it and throw it out the window. I don't know. I could be wrong on that. And it doesn't mean I don't think that our teachers have a responsibility to like highlight ideas of right and wrong. But I don't, I just think that you're coming at it wrong and ineffectively if you're trying to jam it down everyone's throat.
Sure.
In a, like, an obviously, like, you know, morally wrong way.
Sure.
Anyway, go ahead.
So I have to say that there were just so many, I guess, small quirks about being a part of your class that just made it, I guess, unique from every other class that I had. Like,
how I would accept payment,
yeah, Flynn Bucks.
No, not Flynn Bucks. I mean, like, you guys remember when like you could literally pay me good money to get A's, right?
Oh, indeed.
I'm kidding, listeners, folks. Just a small quirk.
Yeah.
He's the guy who we could pay off. No. Yeah, we had Flynn Bucks.
We had Flynn Bucks, which were, I guess, your special form of currency. And
yeah, the pandemic got in the way of really seeing the full potential of the Flynn Bucks.
But, for sure, yeah. I think I still have like a stack of 30 of them.
Oh, really? I've ran out. So. The kids, I had a couple this year, and we started doing it. I have to reprint them. They're like, what are we going to do? Anyway, yeah.
So it's truly these like small moments or even just like the small motifs that happen throughout any class that make it just memorable or like stays in your head for so long. And so what have been, I guess, some of your fondest moments of your classes, of your experience in teaching?
One year we were talking about, I don't know if our class had, we have a good structured academic. It's always the discussions where I go, like not the debates, but the actual discussions, the ones that are organized, well prepared for. But we have this one reoccurring one every year that I'd love on the age of revolution. And the claim is that the age of revolution is not that revolutionary. And it's interesting to see it kind of like the student collective responses like ebb and flow over the years with that claim. Mm-hmm. And in less like, you know, in times of less political crisis, everyone will kind of be like, of course we disagree with that. Mm-hmm. And then in times where the American history is a little bit more popularly in question, it kind of flows to this like, we agree with this claim. This is a period of just pure racism. and that is it. And somewhere in doing it always kind of winds up in a healthy level of a healthy medium of like their shortcomings of the age of revolution, the American, the French, and even the Haitian Revolution. How are we to be thinking about life if we play some counterfactualism as where we might be today? And I had one student one time say, like, listen, there's all these regrettable shortcomings and violations of human rights that we can see in each of these major revolutions in the age of revolution. You know, like Toussaint Louverture, you know, as the leader of the revolution, he before the revolution broke out, he was owning human beings. He was a slaver himself. And then he sends the labor decree in 1800 that kind of looks like slavery's back. You know, you're back in the fields and you're not getting paid according to them. And there's been really awesome moments where students on their own really kind of like utilize the explicit skill that I've been teaching of contextualization and causation and continuous change over time, like kind of all at once. And to say like, you know, life is not that complex, is not that simple. And these are critical moments of really that, you know, would have altered the course of history had they not gone a certain way. And yes, there are regrets of how it was achieved. And this one student made the case really tapping into, you know, the pathos of the moment and saying like, do you think that this classroom would look the way it looks right now had Toussaint Louverture agreed to put himself first in response to Napoleon's demand that the revolutionaries of Saint-Domingue would just go back to being enslaved. He didn't have to do that. And it was a nice tavern. Like, do you think our rich, very like racially varied, ethnically varied, diverse faith community would be what it is in this classroom right now? And then this other student, I remember this student tapped on, you know, like, if the age of revolution isn't revolutionary, then what possibly is? and then as another student comments back, but you know, this is precisely why you'd have discussions like this. And so that was a really great moment because it was rich. And something I keep coming back to and is all I always look forward to every year.
And very quickly, just to close off our discussion, not just for ourselves, Aryan and I, but for the listeners that we have all over the world, we have ranging from our age all the way to maybe 50, 60 years old. I guess there might have been some advice that you have after all of your different experiences that you might be able to give. Maybe just one.
Well, I'm only 36.
True, but I mean,
I know my gray hair might be.
But I mean, comparatively, you've had so many different and varying experiences. Again, touring with your bands and just being a teacher and having all these mentors. What's one advice that maybe you could give our listeners that maybe could help them either better contextualize their world or to, I guess, be successful in the future?
I consider myself extremely successful because, but not because of like degrees I have or, you know, like this superfluous or just, you know, meaningless like follower that has nothing to do with my idea of success. It's because I feel full in life. I've fought for things that really matter. The ability to constantly be in a position of learning and curiosity. And fighting for it isn't just like going to school. It was like fighting it in my own mind of like, what do I really want to do in life that I think is going to be, you know, valuable to my life's experience. But also like part of that fight is rejecting what your peers might think of you or your larger society, you know. Sure. Like I got into some like nice law schools, you know, I got into some really great programs and, or, you know, had the others opportunities in the music world. And I really had to kind of just sort of say like, what am I passionate about? And, you know, it's kind of, I guess it's kind of cliche, but you know, I pursued my passions and my passion was to live a life of learning, earning, and really like yearning. And it's something that my father actually wrote in his high school, his senior quote, you know, learn, earn, and yearn. It was his like senior quote level that I always come back to. He lived that life. And I just kind of went towards that. And I'm just, you know, I have my sadnesses, but I'm a happy guy. I like my life, and I'm really grateful to be liking my life because, you know, it's good to be happy. But like, not many people in the world have the wonderful luxury and privilege to, you know, consider themselves really happy and at peace where they are in life. So I think that like just block out the noise, block out the noise of your friends and, you know, and go towards what you believe will be fulfilling.
Sure.
And fulfilling doesn't always mean like, you know, like constant happiness, you know, just like, what do you think will make for a full lived life? That's my 2 cents.
All right, so that brings us to the end of our discussion, and I think I can speak for both Ali and I when I say that we really, really enjoyed talking with you today. You offered like really great answers to all of our questions, you great perspectives as we've come to expect from you, and I'm sure all of our listeners really learned something new today about education, teaching, and your life. So once again, thank you so much for joining us today,
Mr. Yeah, Fleming. Thanks for having me. This is great, and you guys should do this. Continue doing it. Yeah. Maybe you go off into different schools or something like that, whatever it is. It's a great way to stay in touch.
Yeah.
But wouldn't it be cool if like you had this like long-running podcast that you literally started in high school?
That would be amazing.
It would be cool. The follower, if one thing I've learned is that followership builds over time.
That's the hope, you know?
But it would be cool. It'd be cool. Yeah. It doesn't just because you might, you know, you'd be separated for sure. by land.
Yeah.
The internet has made the opportunities to
continue.
That was our conversation with Mr. Patrick Flynn, a world history teacher at Lexington High School and the popular punk rock vocalist from Have Heart and Fiddlehead. Please check out the description section of this episode for more information about Mr. Flynn.
And with that, thanks for tuning into this episode of Open Floor.
Please follow us on your podcast platform of choice. A full list of where you can find us is available at openfloor.me/listen.
Also, please follow us on Instagram at Open Floor Podcast or on Twitter at The Open Floor for updates on whenever we upload a new episode and much more. Also, please consider supporting the podcast by visiting our website at openfloor.me.
I'm Ali Mosalei.
And I'm Aryan Narayan.
And we'll see you in the next episode of Open Floor.